Have you ever wondered if we are alone in the universe? Is there any scientific evidence showing that an intelligent designer created the heavens and the earth? Welcome to Darwin or Design on Tampa Bay's Christian Talk, AM 570 and 910, WTBN. You may have heard about the debate controversy over intelligent design and Darwinism. Find out what the evidence says about the origin of life and mankind, and just what the experts are saying. Darwin or Design, brought to you by Trinity College of Florida and the C.S. Lewis Society. Now your host, the author of Doubts About Darwin and Darwin Strikes Back, the research professor of Bible and Theology at Trinity College in Trinity, Florida, Dr. Tom Woodward.
And welcome back to Darwin or Design. We hope that you are a regular listener on Saturday afternoon from 5 to 6 on WTBN, Tampa Bay's Christian Talk. And again, of course, this is Tom Woodward coming to you from the studio of WTBN in Tampa, Florida. Perhaps you're listening out there in Lakeland or way up there in Newport Richey or even up to Homosassa, Crystal River, maybe south into the southern end of the central Florida region. We'd love to have you get in touch with us and let us know you're listening. Just give us a call sometime at the office of the C.S. Lewis Society on the campus of Trinity College. The number there, 727-376-6911. And just ask for Dr. Woodward. I may be in the office, I may not, but if I'm not there, they will take a message and make sure that I get back to you and greet you. We've actually had a doctor, I think, from Longboat Key just got in touch with us about a week or two ago. I think I was out of the country at the time, and he said, I would still like a copy of that Why Origins magazine, and left a message in our office, and just today we were able to put together a package and get it out to him. So if anybody out there is still interested, we'll make a couple final offers here in the last couple weeks of June of the beautifully done, just splendidly graphically portrayed case for design in this magazine produced by Campus Crusade for Christ, inspired originally by Bill Bright. This Why Origins magazine is a must have. I can't say must purchase, but we're not selling it. We're actually giving it away. So if you're interested, we still will make that offer good for a couple more weeks. Why Origins, as in the letter Y hyphen Origins, sent to you at no charge from the office of the C.S. Lewis Society, helping skeptics doubt their doubts. And of course, housed on the campus of Trinity College, Florida's first Bible college. I'm professor, research professor, and also handling the Bible, Theology, and History of Science area. And speaking of the History of Science, Michael Cirio at the other side of the controls here, I should say manning the controls. I have very few controls. I have like an up and down volume control in my headphones, earphones. And so we're going to be bringing in to our conversation today on the History of Science, in you might say a subset of that is the history of biology or the history of life or even the history of paleontology. What's paleontology? Well, just a few weeks ago, we were able to interview at Cedarville University a great guy, a professor of biology, geology, and paleontology. I believe actually it's geology and paleontology, Dr. John Whitmore. And just 2 days ago, when I was up in Washington, D.C., giving a presentation on the book Darwin Strikes Back there at the Discovery Institute, I re-met, as it were, from a year ago. Wonderful guy, tremendous scholar in the area of paleontology. Dr. Marcus Ross recently received his PhD from, I believe, the University of Rhode Island. Are you there, Marcus Ross?
Yes, Tom. Great to be on the show with you.
Thank you so much for joining us from your office. Is it in Lynchburg, Virginia?
Yes, Liberty University.
Tremendo. And the students, I understand, at Liberty University have a great opportunity to hear the evidence from the rocks, as it were, from the history of life past, written on those rocks, the fossil evidence, through your classroom. How many years have you been teaching there?
2 years now. Just finished up my second year.
Okay. I would assume that the period of those last 2 years and maybe even the years before that were very busy, besides teaching, with producing your dissertation. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were. I got to the University of Rhode Island to begin my PhD work in fall of 2002, And it took about 4.5 years to complete the doctorate, with about 1.5 of those years spent teaching here at Liberty while polishing off the dissertation. So the last year and a half of the doctorate was very, very busy indeed, as you're trying to figure out, okay, how do I teach a whole bunch of classes and also find time to do some research and writing to finish off some stuff. So my thesis advisor, Dave Fostosky, had two rules. One was growth is painful. And the second one is it always takes longer than you think. And both
I'll have to remember those. Growth is painful, and it always takes longer than you think.
Yep, those were the two rules of our lab.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I know, and I didn't actually have a lab. I guess you might call the communication department here at USF, University of South Florida, as having a communication lab. It was like one huge set of labs that we went through in terms of human communication. But my professor was telling me, oh, yeah, it's probably going to be about 2 years. And I think it was actually 3.5 years producing my dissertation. So I can sympathize. Took me a bit longer. I think I was a little bit slower at the job. So, but let's not compare too much on notes on that. But I would love to compare notes on just things in biology, geology, and the history of life, because you have actually written your dissertation from, as it were, putting yourself in the shoes of the standard evolutionary biologist, even though you are not persuaded in the direction of evolution. Tell us how that worked.
Well, it's one of those things that throughout my entire educational history, I've been in the secular setting from public school, beginning in kindergarten, all the way through to my PhD. I had always been in a public setting, and moreover than that, even a state school setting. My undergrad was at Penn State, followed by a master's degree at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology in Rapid City, and then back for my PhD at the University of Rhode Island. So I had always been very comfortable working within secular systems. You might even say I'm probably a bit more comfortable working in secular systems than I have been at Christian settings, because the Christian ones are so new to me. Mm-hmm. As far as, wow, you, I can pray in class in front of everybody, and this is okay. you know, praise God, I can do that. But it actually did take a little bit of getting used to, you know, not having to sit down and, you know, pray a quick silent prayer over your lunch or, you know, before you teach your class, but showing the students that in front of them is somebody who is a Christian, a theist, a scientist, a paleontologist, and start to see if we can't understand a little bit better about the natural world. So my work at the University of Rhode Island and all of the other programs that I had been in the past had been in the standard old age time frame and assuming evolutionary histories amongst the different organisms that I studied. In a sense, to kind of show people that even though I disagreed, I was still going to learn and understand the arguments that they had to bring forth.
Mm-hmm. So that you understood how they thought, and you could, within their framework of thought, come up with your own, not that you would break the mold or go outside of that framework, but you knew how to discuss their ideas from their standpoint.
Yeah, to discuss the ideas, and ultimately when you get to something like a master's thesis or a PhD dissertation, you actually have to create and solve a problem. Or hopefully not create the problem, but recognize a problem and figure out a way to solve some particular issue. I was once called upon the successful completion of the doctorate by a rather nasty internet blogger. I was called a trained parrot, which I thought was funny in that it was so appallingly wrong, because this person had a PhD, and they should know that you can't get a PhD if you just tell people what they you know, what they've already told you. You've got to come up with something new.
Yeah, fresh research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so that was part of the training. That's part of what needed to be done. The University of Rhode Island or any of the other schools certainly isn't going to have a student come on and do a research project or dissertation that contradicts so strongly the dominant paradigm within their field.
Now, I know that your topic, as I recall, involved some animals, at least from my memory, some animals that are no longer with us on the Earth that are extinct. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were called mosasaurs.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about those guys?
Yeah, they're not named after Moses, and they didn't cross the sea. But mosasaurs are a group of moderate to very large swimming marine reptiles. If you and your audience thinks of a Komodo dragon as the basic lizard, and then you pop all the arms and legs off and you put flippers on them, toss them in the ocean, and that's kind of what you have. But with a mosasaur, the smallest ones were about 10 feet, about the largest Komodo dragon.
Wow.
The biggest ones were well over 50 feet, so the size of a Tyrannosaurus rex.
My goodness.
Swimming in the ocean.
Wow.
I'm very happy they're dead.
They're happy they're extinct.
I'm quite happy they were extinct. If they had anything like the disposition of the typical Komodo dragon or monitor lizards, oh, they're just unpleasant fellows, to be sure.
And then in your research, you had to deal with a problem related to the mosasaurs, and what was that problem?
Twofold. Number one, what I looked to investigate was their ultimate extinction at the end of the Cretaceous on the standard time scale. This is the same time at which the dinosaurs go extinct. And the question for the mosasaurs is, did they kind of peter out towards the end and just kind of gradually die off, or was their extinction a rapid event, at least geologically speaking?
Hmm.
And that part of my dissertation answered yes to the second hypothesis that
it was rapid.
That it was very rapid, that as we look through the rocks, we don't see any change in the diversity of the mosasaurs in a certain area, actually across the entire Atlantic. We see no evidence for any sort of change in their diversity up until the point of their extinction, at which point everybody's gone. So the extinction, at least from a standard geological perspective, is quite catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
And coincides with the large, at least the debris from the large meteor or asteroid that hit the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico.
Right, the Chicxulub crater, supposedly?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was about half of my dissertation, was setting up how do you determine the two sets of rocks across the Atlantic. They're not the same rocks. Mm-hmm. On one side, you've got lots of chalk deposits in England and in the Netherlands and Belgium, mm-hmm. in particular, where I was looking. On the North American side, you've got lots of sandstones and clays and silt. And so you got to figure out ways of tying those rocks together by fossils. That was one chapter. The second chapter was then looking at the mosasaurs within that context, saying, okay, can we understand how quickly they went extinct?
We're going to have to get right back on that. We have some exciting and bombshell discussions coming up with our Professor Marcus Ross. We'll see you right back on Darwin or Design. Thanks, Marcus. Can you hang on?
Absolutely.
Okay, stay with us.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design on Tampa Bay's Christian Talk, AM 570 and 910 WTBN. Once again, here's the host of Darwin or Design, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Yes, we are back with our amazing discussion over the phone with Dr. Marcus Ross, recently minted PhD from the University of Rhode Island in paleontology, the study of the fossil record. And he now teaches at Liberty University, has taught for the last 2 years at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, of course, a very well-known major Christian liberal arts university. And he is still on the phone with us, I believe. Marcus,
yes.
Are you still there? Thank you.
Absolutely.
Dr. Marcus Ross, can I call you Marcus for the broadcast?
Yeah, okay. By all means.
Okay. We will have a special dispensation, a special permission here. I tell my students at the classes there at Trinity College, you can call me Prof. And so that enables them to have kind of a little bit of a, you know, nickname. It's more like a friendly, and it maintains the professorial distance.
Yeah, so yeah, I need a little bit of that. You know,
a little bit of that, yeah. So we'll call you Doc or Prof or Marcus in this case. Okay, we were talking, by the way, let me just mention real quickly that Darwin or Design, a program really which tries each week to explore that borderland between Christian faith, the whole biblical worldview, and science, what we're learning, what we have learned, what we are, experimental research that's going on right now, theoretical dimensions of science. That whole program is about 9 months old and now recently has come under a double support, double sponsorship of not only Trinity College of Florida, but the C.S. Lewis Society. And we are able to bring not only this radio program, but we're able to go to individual churches and even civic clubs. I've been invited just recently to go to the St. Petersburg Kiwanis Club and talk about intelligent design. So if you're a member of Lions or Rotary or Kiwanis or some other civic club out there and wanted to have Dr. Woodward come out and do a presentation on Darwin or Design, I would be delighted to do that. I have about 10 or 15 PowerPoint talks that we could share with you and explain what's available. Also, if your own church would like to have an overview of this topic, either on a Sunday morning, a Sunday night event, please just contact us at Trinity College, which is at 727-376-6911. So that's a little information on how you can extend this discussion into your own world, your own civic or even church context, if you would like to explore these matters in more in greater depth and more detail. Back to Marcus Ross. Marcus, I was excited when I saw that you had completed your PhD at the University of Rhode Island, but then it got some rather unusual media attention, such as the paper of record. Tell us the whole story, if you could. I may interrupt now and then to nudge it, but this is such a great story. Just tell us, just from the get-go, what happened.
Well, actually, it began a couple of years ago. While I was still on campus at the University of Rhode Island, there was a journalistic fellowship that happens at the Graduate School of Oceanography there, which is a very well-known oceanographic institute. Basically, they pull in journalists and science writers and give them a heads up on kind of all the neat stuff that's happening. Well, at that point, somebody had stated that there was a young Earth creationist who was in the geology program at the University of Rhode Island. And so all of a sudden I start getting media calls and whatnot, and nobody in the department wanted this to go forward because I was still doing the dissertation. You know, it was other actions and energy needed to be spent in other ways. So it kind of killed all the stories at that time. Well, as soon as I defended my dissertation in December, one of the faculty members at the University of Rhode Island called up a good friend of theirs at the New York Times and said, "Hey, we just graduated young Earth creationist. Isn't that kind of cool?" Well, yeah, it's kind of cool. So I hadn't even gotten my diploma yet, you know, and wouldn't until even after I think that this event happened. But over Christmas break this past year and into January, I was getting a phone call from Cornelia Dean, who's the science editor for the New York Times. And she wanted to do a phone interview with me. She was calling my advisor, the chair of the department, the individual who had tipped her off, and then she was calling people across the country to get, you know, responses back. And so my advisor was hoping that this would all just kind of die off. He didn't think that there was really much of a story there. After all, I mean, the work that I did at the University of Rhode Island was very conventional. It wasn't trying to upset the apple cart. But nevertheless, it's not every day that a young Earth creationist goes through to a PhD program in paleontology and geology. So praise God, I guess, for a slow news day. I ended up on the front page of the New York Times.
Slow news day. I don't know about that.
It had to be. The big picture on the front was, you know, the 6 or 8 feet of snow they were having in upstate New York at the time. So,
you were front page New York Times.
Yeah, front page above the fold. My forehead was above the fold.
Your forehead above. Yeah, well, you made it.
It was interesting. The article was titled "Believing Scripture but Playing by Science's Rules."
Wow.
And it was a lengthy article. It had to be about 1,600-1,700 words, which is, you know, a section on the front page and then basically a whole half of a page deeper in the A section.
Wow.
So it was quite amazing. When I found out that it was being published that day, I went to the store, I bought a copy of the New York Times, and I immediately just started flipping to section F or G, because I just figured that's where science stuff gets thrown. It's, you know, back of the paper sort of stuff, and I couldn't find it. And so I flipped to the front of the thing just to find out where's the science, and then there's my face right there.
Which you must have been shocked.
I was shocked. I was more shocked because I told them I didn't want any photographs taken. They'd offered to send a photographer. I said no, because I didn't want it to look like I was trying to make this happen. I really didn't want this kind of article to happen.
Right.
Not so much because of me. I'm not worried about my own reputation. That's tanked already, you know. But my advisor at the University of Rhode Island, the other people who were there who spent time nurturing me, could very well come under a lot of fire from some rabid evolutionists.
Sure.
And I didn't want them to catch a lot of flack, or at least I wanted them to have some breathing room before that happened.
Yeah.
But there was none. I mean, I graduated in December, and on February 12th, the New York Times writes about me, and that spawns off, you know, other articles in different newspapers, and the blog traffic went through the roof.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of very bizarre letters and emails as a result.
For example, can you just characterize them, or give maybe one or two examples, or at least characterize them?
Yeah, there are probably about three categories of emails that I would get, or letters, and the first category are Christians who are like-minded, who are encouraging. You know, that's great. I saw the article. Keep doing what you're doing. You know, fabulous. Can you tell me anything else, you know, about what you're doing? That sort of stuff. The next group were Christians who felt that my theology and or science needed fixing. And so I would get these letters with everybody's pet idea of how to harmonize Genesis and science together. And I still get those trickling in every once in a while. And that's amusing, if nothing else. And then the third was the ones that were probably in many ways the most fun to read, the frothing, foaming at the mouth evolutionist, and typically atheist, but sometimes a theistic evolutionist, a Christian evolutionist, is so irate at my own existence that you just end up with this slew of words that certainly aren't going to be spoken over this radio station.
That's right. Yeah, it's not appropriate for WTBN.
Yeah, and people, you know, saying largely that he had lied his way through school, which obviously wasn't true. My advisor had always known that I was a creationist and those sorts of issues. So
Can we stop here and clarify that? Because I know a lot of people out there, and it was maybe alluded to earlier, but maybe not clearly stated. Your advisor, your main professors, when you applied to this program, knew up front where you were personally?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
I had always made it a point where I wanted to tell people as early as possible about the differences that I had with the standard evolutionary picture of things, because I didn't want anybody to have a surprise later on down the road.
Yeah,
I wanted them to know what they were getting. And I just thought, you know, what would the New York Times results have been like from my department if they found out I was a creationist afterwards?
Oh, it would have been terrible.
Yeah, and justifiably so. It would have been, you know, we never really knew this guy. And so I never wanted that to be something that people could say about me. I always wanted them to feel that I was complete and honest and upfront, that even if they disagreed, and we disagreed strongly about Earth history, that they knew what they were getting from the beginning.
And isn't this somewhat parallel, although I know there are some key differences, to Dr. Kurt Wise, I think he's maybe at Southern Seminary now.
Yes, he is.
But he was for many years professor of biology at Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee. Didn't he study at Harvard and get his Ph.D. in paleontology under Stephen Jay Gould?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Our two histories are very similar. My advisor was very Gouldian in his approach to Earth history.
Gouldian. In other words, punctuated equilibrium was a highly plausible mechanism to him.
Yes, yes. And also Gould had a tendency to look at the history of life as being very chance-ridden, what he called contingent, and that kind of if you ran the tape of evolution again, you'd never come up with the same result. Well, my advisor thought that was pretty plausible as well. So Kurt Wise and I, both conservative Christians, young Earth creationists, go through and get degrees in paleontology and have very similar academic histories, especially in terms of our PhD advisors. They're very, very similar types of people. Both of them were secular and agnostic Jewish men, which is really weird when you start piling up all of the similarities along the way. So it was very interesting, and he and I are good friends and colleagues. In fact, I'll be seeing him next week. We have a creation biology meeting here at Liberty University. We're hosting what's called the BSG, the Biological Study Group. And that is a group of scholars, academics within the creation community and others who are interested as well in trying to understand what are the biblical kinds? How can we figure that out? Is there any, and how do we link what's spoken of in Scripture to issues of biological complexity and organization?
Well, we have about 40, 45 seconds left. I want to just really quickly say that having you on the program is a great honor, Marcus. Let me just if you're joining the program today, Marcus Ross recently received his Ph.D. in paleontology from the University of Rhode Island, and just like a matter of weeks later, was featured on the above the crease, as it were, above the fold on the front page of the New York Times as this very unusual young scholar who, as it said in the title of the article, believes in Scripture, but plays by the rules of science. Is that the name of the article, more or less?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was pretty close. Anyway, we will ask Marcus Ross to hang on just a little bit longer from his office there at Liberty University. We will be right back with you on Darwin or Design. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design on Tampa Bay's Christian Talk, AM 570 and 910 WTBN. Once again, here's the host of Darwin or Design, Dr. Tom Woodward.
And thank you for taking your time out on a busy Saturday afternoon to come alongside us in Darwin or Design, coming to you from Tampa Bay's Christian Talk in the center of Tampa. We're actually taping this program just a little bit before it airs, and we're in touch with a great guy, a wonderful young scholar, on the phone with us from his office in Liberty University, Dr. Marcus Ross. Marcus, we would like to just go and talk a little bit more about this area of paleontology. Can you hang on for just a few more minutes?
Oh, glad to.
Okay. I have been presenting in my own talks on Darwinism or design through the years a series of actual pictures of paleontology, evidence from paleontology, especially the fossils and the recreated critters from the Cambrian explosion. If you would just, in a nutshell, explain to the audience out there why this particular ribbon of rock, this particular slab relating to a group of animals, we'll just put it in those terms, and of course, according to contemporary biology, there's this Cambrian era, which I believe dates from about 540 million years ago to, let's say, 490. Is that close enough?
Yeah, that's right on. Okay. Right on point
in terms of their dating. But would you just explain in a nutshell why the Cambrian explosion, why that particular focused topic is so exciting for people who are doubters of Darwin?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, the Cambrian explosion, it surrounds animals. It doesn't surround all types of life, but specifically animals, and mostly animals that we see on the bottom of the sea. We think of clams, trilobites, which look like little underwater cockroaches and things like that. There's a whole slew of different sorts of animal groups that come into existence in the rock record, what in paleontology we call a first appearance. As you're looking from bottom upward in a section of rock, this is the first time you see one. So this involves the first appearance of many, many different types of animals that are found at typically the bottom of the ocean within a relatively thin slice of time, according to the standard geological system. Even though the Cambrian as a period takes place over the course of about 50 million years on the conventional timescale, as you mentioned, from about 540 to 490 million years ago. The actual first appearance of most of these animals is restricted to a much smaller window, at the most somewhere around 10 million years, but perhaps smaller still, on the order of 5. And there are even some who might claim that it's smaller than that still. Yeah. And what we see is not just a group of animals that kind of just pop into existence, but animals that are extremely different from one another. If you think of the difference between a clam and a horseshoe crab as two different types of animals, the clam obviously being a mollusk and something that's good for chowders and soups and stews, and the horseshoe crab, which was really not tasty at all, very, really bad stuff.
I've never tried a horseshoe crab. Sorry.
Historically, interestingly enough, the pilgrims had eaten a whole bunch of those up in Massachusetts before. They were told, you know, there's lots of lobsters to eat, and so they started eating the horseshoe crabs and thought they were awful, and the natives at the time said, "No, that's not the ones we were talking about."
True story. You heard it here first on WTBN.
Strange stuff. The things you learn when you live in New England.
Wow.
But the horseshoe crab, which is fairly similar in some ways to a trilobite, has a jointed exoskeleton. It's got big, hard outside skeleton to it, jointed legs, eyes, and all this sort of stuff. And the clam, on the other hand, has got, well, two shells that make up the outside, and then on the inside you've got stomach and a little pump to help move fluid around. The organisms are fundamentally different in the way that their bodies are constructed. What we see in the Cambrian is not just differences amongst, something like the trilobites and a clam, differences of that scale between those two and at least 17 more groups of animals that make their first appearance. There are at least something like 19 to 20 major groups of organisms, major groups of animals, which we call in biology phyla, that make their first appearance pretty much all at the same time in the Cambrian. Now, this is fairly mysterious. The standard Darwinian expectation of the fossil record is that, well, you start with one group of animals and eventually it evolves into a couple and a few more, and you kind of have this idea of this large branching tree. It's the only diagram Darwin put in the entire book of The Origin of Species, was this idea of a gradual tree-like unfolding. But what we see instead with the Cambrian is like all of a sudden a whole forest just explodes and there's nothing below it that indicates ancestry amongst the various groups. So for proponents of intelligent design or various types of creationism, this is rather interesting sorts of stuff. It can possibly, if you're looking at it still on the old age timescale, indicate a point of creation for an intelligent agent such as God. Or if you're looking at it from a young Earth perspective, as I might, it's probably going to be looking at the first inundatory phases, the first flooding stages of the flood of Noah's flood itself. So there's a couple of different ways that various critics of Darwin can look at this sort of thing, but no matter which way it is that you look at it, it certainly isn't fitting the typical pattern that Darwin would have expected of the rock record.
So it's an, you know, if I can bring out my own analogy, instead of finding, let's say, at the lower level of rock, if we can use the analogy of human contraptions, instead of finding maybe a unicycle and then all of a sudden a bicycle and then a little bit later a tricycle, just a kind of a very gradual development of little things, you find bicycles, tricycles, 747s, army tanks, helicopters, cars, they're all just bursting on the scene.
Yeah.
And you know, if you translate that into biology, you find this tremendous differential just suddenly appearing out of nowhere.
Yeah, it would be very much like trying to analogize it, seeing a Harley, a Ford Model T, a Boeing 747, like you mentioned, as well as, you know, a Caterpillar, you know, Earth Mover or something like that. All this stuff
suddenly appears.
That is very different from each other, and they just kind of pop on the scene all together.
With no clear lines of transitions connecting them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, this, of course, was, I think, from my own study, this was a fact that was something of an embarrassment already in Darwin's day. And hasn't the lack of transitions between phyla remained fairly absolute since then?
It has. Evolutionary scientists are continuing to look for presumed, you know, ancestors to these various approaches. And they don't look at Earth history quite the same way that Darwin used to. It was a profound problem for Darwin at the time, and he pretty much punted in 1859.
Punted. You know, I can hear the football go boom into the air. I don't want to deal with that.
I have no idea how to deal with this, but paleontology is very young as a science, and so in the future we'd expect to find more.
I'll wait to my next four downs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, hopefully you get it inside their opponent's 20 and you can get it back with some time on the clock. it seems that the other side has been, you know, taking the ball and marching down the field with it, which is becoming more and more of a problem for Darwin. The contemporary evolutionists are, I don't think, see this as the same kind of profound problem that Darwin did. They're already convinced that his general thesis on the history of life is correct, and so they're more concerned of, okay, how do we figure out the mechanism that could do something like this? You know, what sort of genetic changes do we need? What sorts of developmental changes can we use in order to do the hocus pocus that, that evolution needs to do to get this explosion explained?
Right. And I think that if I remember the thesis of Stephen Meyer's very controversial article, which came out in a peer-reviewed journal located, I think, back about 3 years ago, you know, the Biological Society of Washington, or the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington, his article pointed to this problem, but even said that there was an informational or DNA problem linked to that. Could you explain that in a nutshell?
Well, sure, because each of these organisms requires a certain set of information in order to build them. To go back to the mechanical ideas that you brought out, a Boeing 747 has a blueprint and a series of instructions, and these have to be followed very, very specifically. Even if you've got all the parts to a Boeing 747, you still have to assemble them in, at times, very particular ways. You can't wait until it's all put together to get, then go in and say, well, where do these electronics go? No, those have got to be put in, you know, before paneling and whatnot in the cockpit. Organisms are very much the same way. Not only do they have the instructions, the blueprint, which we might consider the DNA, there's also all sorts of developmental timing devices that make sure that everything gets built in the proper sequence. And completed by the time, you know, gestation, and they are about to come out be born, et cetera. So we have to deal with the change not only in structure from one organism to another, if evolution is to be true. You've got to code for all the information that makes for the new structures. A clam doesn't have the information to build feet or to build an exoskeleton like a horseshoe crab. So if the horseshoe crab descended from a worm or something like that, then you've got to take the information to build a worm, and then add on to it all the stuff that you need to build the external shells and the eyes and the nervous system and the legs and all this stuff and all the musculature that goes with it. So it's not simply just saying, well, we can kind of imagine a way where you could get a worm to become a trilobiter or a horseshoe crab. No, you actually have to deal with the level of information and the process of actually constructing the animal in development to really do an explanation of evolution justice here. And that certainly is not out there in the current literature.
And in case you're just tuning in, this is Dr. Marcus Ross, professor of geology and recently minted PhD in paleontology from the University of Rhode Island, who was featured on the front page of the February 12th issue of the New York Times, the paper of record, sharing a little bit about his perspective on paleontology. Just a real quick, we have about 45 seconds left in this segment. In a nutshell, when I'm telling students that today the evidence points to sudden appearance of new forms followed by stasis, followed by stability or the resistance to profound change, would I be accurate, from your point of view as a paleontologist, would I be accurate to say that those are the two dominant features of the fossil record?
Those are very dominant features of the fossil record when you're talking about individual species and even genera as we find them in the fossil record. There is an extraordinary amount of stability followed by either abrupt appearance or disappearance once they're gone.
Mm-hmm. So I can continue to convey that information to my students and to audiences without fear of profound contradiction.
Oh, you'll get it anyway, but you'll be okay.
Yes, I will go ahead in the face of the hard north winds. You are listening to Darwin or Design. You're listening to not only Tom Woodward, but Marcus Ross, professor at Liberty University. He will stay with us for just a few more minutes into segment four. We are having one of the best Darwin or Design days we've ever had. Don't go away.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design on Tampa Bay's Christian Talk, AM 570 and 910 WTBN. Once again, here's the host of Darwin or Design, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Thank you for staying along on the fourth segment of one of the most exciting programs we have ever had an opportunity to produce. We have on the other end of the line Marcus Ross, professor of geology at Liberty University, one of the finest Christian institutions in the world today. And he lectures regularly and teaches students from all over the U.S., I would imagine. Is that true, Marcus?
Yeah. Liberty commands students from every state in the country, as well as quite a number of foreign nations as well.
And what courses do you teach up there?
Well, on the geology side of things, I teach an introductory to earth science class, which is mostly geology as much as I can get away with, and a little bit of oceanography and some meteorology as well. And then the other class that I teach revolves the other half of my existence at Liberty, which is assistant director for the Center for Creation Studies. And the course that the Center for Creation Studies teaches here at Liberty University is called History of Life, and it's a general survey creation evolution course. Taught from a distinctively young Earth perspective, and is required for all residential students at Liberty University. So everybody who comes to Liberty University gets a primer on the creation evolution history.
Okay,
and
wow.
Issue.
Well, this is really, I mean, I did not, you know, realize that you were doing that particular creation-oriented course. That's a perfect segue, I would say, into getting more into the area of biblical integration. And I think that you and I would have a very similar view, maybe not dotting all the I's the same way, but I think both of us would view Genesis as not just spiritual or metaphorical truth. It contains that, but it also gives us a fairly accurate thumbnail, conveying to us what God wanted us to know about the broad brush strokes of Earth history. Would that be an accurate summary of your view?
I think that's correct, that Genesis is something that, as a document, needs to be taken in a serious manner historically, and not just something that is going to be conveniently relegated to spiritual or vaguely faith in some way, simply because it is challenged in many ways at present by conventional approaches to secular approaches to Earth history.
Mm-hmm. And in that regard, so when we're dealing with God creating in the Genesis account various kinds of animals, where in your view does science seem to back up the creation of kinds? In other words, does that, as a scientist, you know, not just in geology but biology and other areas that you deal with, how does this statement of the various kinds being created fit with your understanding of the evidence?
Well, one thing that I think is very, very interesting is that there's far more hybridization amongst animals than is commonly thought in nature. We think of species as something, and typically defined in our biology textbooks, as a group of animals that will reproduce pretty much only within themselves as a group. So we think of a gray fox or as a wolf or something like that as a distinct species. What isn't commonly known is that every single species within, the genus Canidae, which includes our foxes, our wolves, coyotes, dingoes, and the domestic dogs, can interbreed in a complex web with one another. That house dogs can mate with wolves or coyotes or dingoes, and even there are other segues and connections through to the foxes.
And produce fertile offspring?
And produce sometimes fertile offspring, sometimes non-fertile offspring.
Mm-hmm.
But the ability to produce fertile offspring, I think, is a bit artificial in terms of its construct, because there's a whole host of reasons and genetic consequences that could possibly turn off why an organism might not be able to breed successfully afterwards. Mm-hmm. It might sterilize it. It's far more interesting, I think, that organisms across sometimes very, very distant distances could actually end up reproducing with each other. The same is true with the entire range of cats, that you can pass genetic information from, you know, Mr. Fluffy or Boots the cat all the way over to a lion and a tiger, that there is a direct chain of genetic information that you can mate small house cats with small feral cats, which can go to slightly larger feral cats, and onward through to the largest cats that we have on the planet.
Hmm.
That's something that is, I think, something we would expect if the biblical kind concept is to be taken seriously, but something that typically evolutionary biology expects there to be far more rigidity and far more hard and fast boundaries between organisms than we actually do see.
Wow. I mean, that's an insight that I don't know if I have ever even heard presented, let alone presented myself. So thank you for bringing us up on that.
It's a fascinating group of research that's going on right now for the creationists in that respect.
In regard to the global flood, you would hold to, as opposed to the often heard in the ID circles, the idea of a local flood, you would hold to a global flood. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see much way of getting around that scripturally.
Yeah, and I would be entirely in agreement with you. I think that the idea of a local flood flies in the face of fairly straightforward descriptions there in Genesis 6 through 9. Let's go into that a little bit. What would you see as some of the most important geological evidences that seem to buttress or support or fit nicely with the idea of a global flood?
Well, one of them actually goes back to what we were talking about before regarding the Cambrian. One of the interesting features, particularly throughout all of North America, or virtually throughout all of North America, is that towards the bottom end of the geological column, near the Cambrian or sometimes slightly below, is a large unconformity. This is a term geologists use to note a break in the rocks. And in this case, it's actually called the Great Unconformity because it can be traced across almost the entire western half of the continent. Basically, you've got crystalline rocks or sometimes some sedimentary rocks, but these basement rocks that are making up the bottom of the continent itself. Then you have this large erosion and scour mark followed by the deposition of broken bits of trilobites and the things that make up some of the Cambrian explosion, et cetera, directly above that. It seems to me that that could be a good signal that we had an initial burst of geologic activity that resulted in carving out large areas of land and depositing material that was on the ocean onto what is now the continent.
Hmm. In the regard to the evidence, let me just go ahead and shift a moment to the vast dinosaur graveyards that I refer to sometimes in my classes at Trinity College. And I refer especially to the quotes that I have from an earlier, I believe it was a book put together by the Institute for Creation Research, I think co-authored by Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish. I'm not sure the authors exactly. Maybe it was a group effort, a group authorship. But there was much brought out about the dinosaur graveyards found by Edwin Colbert, if I remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an earlier, I think early 1900s, when he was producing a tremendous number of books on dinosaurs, but was amazed as he, around the world, in site after site, found heaps, literally like jammed in piles of dinosaur skeletons all heaped together in a jackstraw puzzle. And I didn't know if you'd had a chance to see any of that information for yourself. I actually viewed a slab cut out from such a dinosaur graveyard and placed on display in the American Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm.
And the little display, you know, one of the little stanchions had a kind of a tilted display board, and it said, this was taken from, you know, and it named the exact location out west in the U.S., and it said, and you will notice here, all kind of intricately interwoven or kind of jammed in kind of randomly are the dinosaur skeletons from, I think they said, 10 or 15 species. I mean, the block was not more than 8 or 9 feet long, maybe 5 feet wide. So
yeah.
I didn't know if you could comment. Is that a major evidence, or have you seen anything like that?
Yeah. My guess is that what you got to see at the American Museum was a piece from the Morrison Formation, and in particular a quarry out in Utah that is very famous, the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry. Visitor Center, unfortunately, is closed. It was falling away from the rock face, so they had to shut that down.
Wow!
And hopefully it'll come up in the next few years or so. But I had a chance to actually visit it shortly before it was closed down. And you go up and you look, and there's this enormous wall, probably about the size of a football field, or maybe a little bit smaller. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of fossils that are excavated so that you can see them on the face of the wall. And there seems also, as I was remarking this with, as you mentioned earlier, Dr. Kurt Wise, he and I and another colleague, Todd Wood, who's at Bryan College, were visiting this location and seeing that if you step back and look at it, you can see almost a flow direction going from the left side of the quarry face over to the right, animals being piled up in a particular direction as well, which geologists and paleontologists use to try and infer, okay, where was water flowing from one point to another? So thinking of what sorts of materials have to be flowing to move large dinosaurs and transport them, whoever knows how long they happen to be, but you've got whole long-necked sauropod dinosaurs that are being transported along with meat-eating dinosaurs and smaller ones and big ones and being put into this big log jam. Some very serious catastrophic processes. The question for us who hold to a global flood is this directly part of the flood? Is this something that was happening towards the later stages of the flood or even post-flood? Some of our questions revolve around what parts of the geological column are we going to actually assign to be flood rocks or not?
Because I've even heard some geologists say that from the Cretaceous on up, the post-Cretaceous, I guess, was it tertiary?
Yes.
Yeah, that section of rocks near the top of the geological column may have been caused by post-flood catastrophes as the Earth was kind of coming back into an equilibrium over a period of hundreds of years, perhaps.
Is
that a valid point of view?
That is one of many, I think, valid points of view. At the moment, most creationists agree that the base of the flood starts somewhere around the Cambrian explosion or so. That's a fairly strong consensus. There is, at the moment, though, no consensus within the creation community as to when to draw the end of the flood, which is, by its nature, going to be a very dynamic and complex sort of thing. You know, is it the end of the flood everywhere in the world when Noah steps off of the ark? Or is it only the end of the flood where he's at and there's more processes going on elsewhere?
Yes.
So we can expect as the plates are shifting and moving and readjusting that trying to pick out the end of that boundary is going to be pretty difficult. I do tend to think that most of the age of mammals, as it's typically called, the Cenozoic, is probably post-flood. But there are others who draw it towards the end of that as well.
Yeah. That's extremely helpful information. And, of course, the flood, if we can segue into our final comment, my final topic for the day is that the flood came as a result of the patience of God warning mankind about his new spiraling downward into what was described in Genesis 6 as every imagination of man's heart, the thought of its heart, was only evil continually. And so the flood really is the judgment. If I can just kind of weigh in here for a second, I know that we're not that bad off today, but I think that the sense of rebellion against what we would recognize is absolute good contained in God, embodied in God, expressed throughout the hearts of mankind in their deep recesses of their conscience. Would you not agree that the moral problem today, I mean, the most important problem in any university or any conversation in the living rooms of the America even today, would be the moral problem in realizing that Christ is the only solution. He died for our sins. He paid the penalty on the cross. You would say that you've experienced that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely.
And so Marcus Ross and I have both sensed God's, as it were, a redeeming grace being provided. It's available to anyone, all of you out there. We love and enjoy having you on our program, listening to our program every week. Thank you for joining us again on Darwin or Design. Thank you, Marcus Ross. It was a great time together.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Okay. We'll see you next week.
For more information about the C.S. Lewis Society, intelligent design, and upcoming events, visit our website, www.apologetics.org. And join us each Saturday afternoon at 5 for Darwin or Design on Tampa Bay's Christian Talk, AM 570 and 910, WTBN.